The water had hit him like a blow, stinging his whole body and knocking the breath out of him. He fell through murky depths. He could not swim, and was certain he would drown. But he had not been in the water more than a few seconds when he felt himself plucked up by a strong current and borne away at great speed. By some accident, the action of water brought him to the surface every now and then, and he was able to snatch a breath. Moment after moment he continued in a state of the most abject terror, quite unable to save himself. Once the racing water bore him up high, and for an instant he saw the sunlit quayside, a place he did not recognize. He saw white foaming water dashing at the stones, soaking people and houses. He saw people's shocked faces. He understood that he had not been driven out to sea, as he had supposed, but even then it did not occur to him that the current was in any way unnatural. Sometimes it carried him on vigorously in one direction, sometimes all was confusion, and he was certain that his end was upon him. Then suddenly the water seemed to grow tired of him. The motion ceased upon the instant, and he was thrown up onto some stone steps. He was vaguely aware of cold air and buildings around him. He drew in great shuddering, body-racking breaths of air, and just as it became easier to breathe, he vomited up quantities of cold salt water. Then for a long time, he simply lay there with his eyes closed, as a man might lie upon a lover's breast. He had no thought of anything at all. If any desires remained in him, then they were simply to lie there forever. Much later, he became aware, firstly, that the stones were probably very dirty, and secondly, that he was fearfully cold. He began to wonder why it was so quiet, and why no one came to help him. He sat up and opened his eyes. Darkness was all around him. Was he in a tunnel? A cellar? Under the earth? Any of these would have been quite horrible, since he had not the least idea how he had got there or how he was going to get out again. But then he felt a thin, chill wind upon his cheek. He looked up and saw the white winter stars. Night. No, 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 he pleaded. He shrank back against the stones of the quay, whimpering. The buildings were dark and utterly silent. The only live, bright things were the stars. Their constellations looked to Drawlight like gigantic glittering letters, letters in an unknown alphabet. For all he knew, the magician had formed the stars into these letters and used them to write a spell against him. All that could be seen in any direction was black night, stars, and silence. There was no light in any of the houses, and if what Drawlight had been told was true, there were no people in any of the houses. Unless, of course, the magician was there. With great reluctance, he stood up and looked around. Nearby was a little bridge. On the other side of the bridge, an alley disappeared between the high walls of dark houses. He could go that way, or he could choose the pavement by the side of the canal. It was frosted with starlight and looked particularly eerie and exposed. He chose the alley and darkness. He crossed the bridge and passed between the houses. Almost immediately, the alley opened out into a square. Several other alleys led away from the square. Which way should he go? He thought of all the black shadows he would have to pass, all the silent doorways. Suppose he never got out. He felt sick and faint with fear. There was a church in the square. Even by starlight, its facade was a monstrous thing. It bulged with pillars and bristled with statues. Angels with outspread wings held trumpets to their lips. A shadowy figure held out its arms beneath a stone canopy. Blind faces gazed down at Drawlight from dark arches. How do I know the magician is not there? He thought. He began to examine each black figure in turn to see if it was Jonathan Strange. Once he had begun, it was difficult to stop. He fancied that if he looked away for a moment, one of the figures would move. He had almost persuaded himself that it was safe to walk away from the church when something caught his eye, the merest possible irregularity in the deep blackness of the doorway. He looked closer. There was something or someone lying on the steps. A man. He lay stretched out upon the stones as if in a swoon, face down, with his arm thrown over his head. For several moments, oh, but it seemed like an eternity, Drawlight waited to see what would happen. Nothing happened. Then it came to him in an instant. The magician was dead. Perhaps in his madness he had killed himself. The sense of joy and relief was overwhelming. In his excitement, he laughed out loud. An extraordinary sound in all the silence. The dark figure in the dark doorway did not stir. He drew closer until he was leaning over the figure. There was no sound of breathing. He wished he had a stick to poke it. Without warning, the figure turned over. Drawlight gave a little yelp of fright. Silence. Then, "I know you," whispered Strange. Drawlight tried to laugh. He had always employed laughter as a means to placate his victims. Laughter was a soothing thing, was it not? All friends together. But all that came out of his mouth was a queer braying sound. Strange stood up and took a few steps towards Drawlight. Drawlight backed away. In the starlight, Drawlight could see the magician more clearly. He could begin to trace the features of the man he had known. Strange's feet were bare. His coat and shirt hung open, and he had clearly not shaved in days. "I know you," whispered Strange again. You are... He moved his hands through the empty air as if tracing magical symbols. "You are a Lucrocature." Echoed Drawlight. "You are the wolf of the evening. You prey upon men and women. Your father was a hyena, and your mother a lioness. You have the body of a lion. Your hooves are cloven. You cannot look behind you. You have one long tooth and no gums, yet you can take human shape and lure men to you with a human voice." "No, no," pleaded Drawlight. He wanted to say more. He wanted to say that he was none of those things, that Strange was quite mistaken. But his mouth was too dry and weak from terror. It was no longer able to form the words. "Now," said Strange calmly, "I shall return you to your proper form." He raised his hands. "Abracadabra," he cried. Drawlight fell to the ground, screaming over and over again, and Strange burst into such peals of laughter, eerie mad laughter, that he bent double and staggered about the square. Eventually the fear of one man and the hilarity of the other subsided. Drawlight realized that he had not been transformed into the horrible nightmare creature, and Strange grew calmer, almost severe. "Lucrocator," he whispered, "stand up." Still whimpering, Drawlight got to his feet. "Lucrocator, why did you come here? No, wait. I know this." Strange snapped his fingers. "I brought you here. Lucrocator, tell me, why do you spy on me? What have I ever done that is secret? Why did you not come here and ask me? I would have told you everything." "They made me do it. Lascelles and Norrell. Lascelles paid my debts so I could leave the King's Bench." Footnote 1. The prison where Drawlight was imprisoned for debt in November 1814. "I have always been your friend." Drawlight faltered slightly. It seemed unlikely that even a madman would believe this. Strange raised his head, as if to give Drawlight a defiant look. But in the darkness, Drawlight could not see his expression. "I have been mad, Lucrocator," he hissed. "Did they tell you that? Well, it is true. I have been mad, and I will be so again. But since you came to this city, I have refrained from certain spells, so that when I saw you, I would be in my right mind, my old mind, so that I would know you and I would know what I meant to say to you. I have learned many things in the darkness, Lucrocator, and one of them is this. I cannot do this alone. I have brought you here to help me."
"Have you? I'm glad. I will do anything. Oh, thank you, thank you."
But as he spoke, Drawlight wondered how long Strange meant to keep him there. The thought turned his heart to water.
What is...
Strange appeared to be having difficulty catching hold of his thoughts. He trawled his hands through the air.
"What is the name of Pole's wife?"
"Lady Pole."
"Yes, but I mean... her other names."
"Emma Wintertown."
"Yes, that is it. Emma Wintertown. Where is she now?"
They've taken her to a madhouse in Yorkshire. It's supposed to be a great secret, but I found it out. I knew a man in the King's Bench whose son's sweetheart is a mantua maker, and she knew all about it because she was employed to make Lady Pole's Yorkshire clothes. It's very cold in Yorkshire. They've taken her to a place called Star or something. Lady Pole, I mean, not the mantua maker. Stair something. Wait, I'll tell you, I know this, I swear. Stair Cross Hall in Yorkshire.
Stair Cross? I know that name.
Yes, you do, because the tenant is a friend of yours. He was once a magician in Newcastle or York or one of those northern places. Only I do not know his name. It seems that Mr. Norrell did him an unkindness once, or maybe twice. So when Lady Pole became mad, Childermas thought to mend matters a little by recommending him as a madhouse keeper to Sir Walter.
There was a silence. Drawlight wondered how much Strange had understood. Then Strange said, "Emma Wintertown is not mad. She appears mad, but that is Norrell's fault. He summoned a fairy to raise her from the dead, and in exchange, he gave the fairy all sorts of rights over her. This same fairy threatened the liberty of the King of England, and has enchanted at least two more of His Majesty's subjects, one of them my wife." He paused. "Your first task, Le Crocuteur, is to tell John Childermas what I have just told you, and to deliver this to him." Strange took something out of a pocket of his coat and handed it to Drawlight. It appeared to be a small box, like a snuff box, except that it was a little longer and narrower than snuff boxes usually are. Drawlight took it and put it in his own pocket. Strange gave a long sigh. The effort of speaking coherently seemed to exhaust him. Your second task is to take a message to all the magicians in England. Do you understand me?
Oh, yes, but...
But what?
But there is only one.
What?
Well, there is only one magician, sir. And now that you're here, only one magician remains in England.
Strange seemed to consider this for a moment.
My pupils, he said.
My pupils are magicians. All the men and women who ever wanted to be Norrell's pupils are magicians. Childermas is another, Segundus another, Honeyfoot, the subscribers to the magical journals, the members of the old societies. England is full of magicians. Hundreds, thousands, perhaps. Norrell refused them. Norrell denied them. Norrell silenced them. But they are magicians nonetheless. Tell them this.
He passed his hand across his forehead and breathed hard for a moment.
Tree speaks to stone. Stone speaks to water. But it's not so hard as we have supposed. Tell them to read what is written in the sky. Tell them to ask the rain. All of John Usklas's old alliances are still in place. I am sending messengers to remind the stones and the sky and the rain of their ancient promises. Tell them. But again Strange could not find the words he wanted. He drew something in the air with a gesture.
I cannot explain it, he said. Le Crocuteur, do you understand?
Yes,
said Drawlight, though he had not the least idea what Strange was talking about.
Good.
Now repeat to me the messages I have given you. Tell them back to me. Drawlight did so. Long years of collecting and repeating malicious gossip about his acquaintance had made him adept at remembering names and facts. He had the first message perfectly, but the second had descended to a few garbled sentences about magicians standing in the rain, looking at stones.
I will show you, said Strange,
and then you will understand. Le Crocuteur, if you perform these three tasks, I shall take no revenge on you. I shall not harm you. Deliver these three messages, and you may return to your night hunts, to your devouring of men and women.
Thank you,
breathed Drawlight gratefully, until a horrible realization gripped him.
Three? But, sir, you only gave me two.
Three messages, Le Crocuteur, said Strange wearily. You must deliver three messages.
Yes, but you've not told me what the third is.
Strange made no reply. He turned away, muttering to himself. In spite of all his terror, Drawlight had a great desire to get hold of the magician and shake him. He might have done it, too, if he thought it would do any good. Tears of self-pity began to trickle down his face. Now Strange would kill him for not performing the third task, and it was not his fault.
"Le Croqueter," said Strange, suddenly returning. "Bring me a drink of water."
Drawlight looked around. In the middle of the square, there was a well. He went over to it and found a horrible old iron cup attached to the stones by a length of rusting chain. He pushed aside the well cover, drew up a pail of water, and dipped the cup into the water. He hated touching it. Curiously, after everything that had happened to him that day, it was the iron cup he hated the most. All of his life, he had loved beautiful things, but now everything that surrounded him was horrible. It was the magician's fault. How he hated them.
"Sir? Lord Magician?" he called out. "You'll have to come here to drink."
He showed the iron chain by way of an explanation. Strange came forward, but he did not take the proffered cup. Instead, he took a tiny phial out of his pocket and handed it to Drawlight. "Put 6 drops in the water," he said. Drawlight took out the stopper. His hand was trembling so much that he feared he would pour the whole thing on the ground. Strange did not appear to notice. Drawlight shook in some drops. Strange took the cup and drank the water down. The cup fell from his hand. Drawlight was aware, he did not know how exactly, that Strange was changed. Against the starry sky, the black shape of his figure sagged and his head drooped. Drawlight wondered if he were drunk. But how could a few drops of anything make a man drunk? Besides, he did not smell of strong liquor. He smelt like a man who had not washed himself or his linen for some weeks. And there was another smell, too, one that had not been there a minute ago, a smell like old age and 50 cats. Drawlight had the strangest feeling. It was something he had felt before when magic was about to happen. Invisible doors seemed to be opening all around him. Winds blew on him from far away, bringing scents of woods, moors, and bogs. Images flew unbidden into his mind. The houses around him were no longer empty. He could see inside them as if the walls had been removed. Each dark room contained, not a person exactly, a being, an ancient spirit. One contained a fire, another a stone, yet another a shower of rain, yet another a flock of birds, yet another a hillside, yet another a small creature with dark and fiery thoughts, and on. "What are they?" he whispered in amazement. He realized that all the hairs on his head were standing on end, as if he'd been electrified. Then a new, different sensation took him. It was a sensation not unlike falling, and yet he remained standing. It was as if his mind had fallen down. He thought he stood upon an English hillside. Rain was falling. It twisted in the air like grey ghosts. Rain fell upon him, and he grew thin as rain. Rain washed away thought, washed away memory, all the good and the bad. He no longer knew his name. Everything was washed away like mud from a stone. Rain filled him up with thoughts and memories of its own. Silver lines of water covered the hillside like intricate lace, like the veins of an arm. Forgetting that he was, or ever had been, a man, he became the lines of water. He fell into the earth with the rain. He thought he lay beneath the earth, beneath England. Long ages passed. Cold and rain seeped through him. Stones shifted within him. In the silence and the dark, he grew vast. He became the earth. He became England. A star looked down on him and spoke to him. A stone asked him a question, and he answered it in its own language. The river curled at his side. Hills budded beneath his fingers. He opened his mouth and breathed out spring. He thought he was pressed into a thicket in a dark wood in winter. The trees went on forever, dark pillars separated by thin white slices of winter light. He looked down. Young saplings pierced him through and through. They grew up through his body, through his feet and hands. His eyelids were no longer closed because twigs had grown up through them. Insects scuttled in and out of his ears. Spiders built nests and webs in his mouth. He realized he had been entwined in the wood for years and years. He knew the wood, and the wood knew him. There was no saying any longer what was wood and what was man. All was silent. Snow fell. He screamed. Blackness. Like rising up from beneath dark waters, Drawlight came to himself. Who it was that released him, whether Strange, or the wood, or England itself, he did not know, but he felt its contempt as it cast him back into his own mind. The ancient spirits withdrew from him. His thoughts and sensations shrank to those of a man. He was dizzy and reeling from the memory of what he'd endured. He examined his hands and rubbed the places on his body where the trees had pierced him. They seemed whole enough, but oh, but they hurt. He whimpered and looked around for Strange. The magician was a little way off, crouching by a wall, muttering magic to himself. He struck the wall once. The stones bulged, changed shape, became a raven. The raven opened its wings and with a loud caw flew up towards the night sky. He struck the wall again. Another raven emerged from the wall and flew away. Then another and another, and on, thick and fast they came, until all the stars above were blotted out by black wings. Strange raised his hand to strike again.
Lord Magician, gasped Drawlight, you have not told me what the third message is.
Strange looked round. Without warning, he seized Drawlight's coat and pulled him close. Drawlight could feel Strange's stinking breath on his face, and for the first time, he could see his face. Starlight shone on fierce wild eyes from which all humanity and reason had fled.
Tell Nurl, I am coming, hissed Strange. Now, go.
Drawlight did not need to be told twice. He sped away through the darkness. Ravens seemed to pursue him. He could not see them, but he heard the beating of their wings and felt the currents in the air that those wings created. Halfway across a bridge, he tumbled without warning into dazzling light. Instantly, he was surrounded by the sound of birdsong and of people talking. Men and women were walking and talking and going about their everyday pursuits. Here was no terrible magic, only the everyday world, the wonderful, beautiful, everyday world. Drawlight's clothes were still drenched in seawater, and the weather was cruelly cold. He was in a part of the city he did not recognize. No one offered to help him, and for a long time he walked about, lost and exhausted. Eventually, he happened upon a square he knew, and was able to make his way back to the little tavern where he rented a room. By the time he reached it, he was weak and shivering. He undressed and rinsed the salt from his body as best he could. Then he lay down on his little bed. For the next 2 days, he lay in a fever. His dreams were unspeakable things, filled with darkness, magic, and the long, cold ages of the earth. And all the time he slept, he was filled with dread lest he wake to find himself under the earth or crucified by a winter wood. By the middle of the third day, he was recovered enough to get up and go to the harbor. There, he found an English ship bound for Portsmouth. He showed the captain the letters and papers Lascelles had given him, promising a large fee to the ship that bore him back to England, and signed by two of the most famous bankers in Europe. By the fifth day, he was on a ship, bound for England. A thin, cold mist lay upon London, mimicking, or so it seemed, the thin, cold character of Stephen's existence. Lately, his enchantment weighed upon him more heavily than ever. Joy, affection, and peace were all strangers to him now. The only emotions that pierced the clouds of magic around his heart were of the bitterest sort. Anger, resentment, and frustration. The division and estrangement between him and his English friends grew ever deeper. The gentleman might be a fiend, but when he spoke of the pride and self-importance of Englishmen, Stephen found it hard to deny the justice of what he said. Even lost hope, dreary as it was sometimes a welcome refuge from English arrogance and English malice. There at least Stephen had never needed to apologize for being what he was. There he had only ever been treated as an honored guest. On this particular winter's day, Stephen was in Sir Walter Pole's stables in the Harley Street Mews. Sir Walter had recently purchased a pair of very fine greyhounds, much to the delight of his male servants, who idled away a large part of every day in visiting the dogs and admiring them and talking with varying degrees of knowledge and understanding of their likely prowess in the field. Stephen knew he ought to check this bad habit, but he found he did not really care enough to do it. Today, when Robert the footman had invited him to come and see the dogs, Stephen, far from scolding him, had put on his hat and coat and gone with him. Now he watched Robert and the grooms fussing over the dogs. He felt as if he was on the other side of a thick and dirty pane of glass. Suddenly, each man straightened himself and filed out of the stables. Stephen shivered. Experience had taught him that such unnatural behavior invariably announced the arrival of the gentleman with the thistledown hair. Now here he was, lighting up the cramped dark stables with the brilliance of his silver hair and the glitter of his blue eyes and the brightness of his green coat. Full of loud talk and laughter, never doubting for a moment that Stephen was as delighted to see him as he was to see Stephen. He was as pleased with the dogs as the servants had been, and called on Stephen to admire them with him. He spoke to them in his own language, and the dogs leapt up and barked joyously, seeming more enamored of him than anyone they had ever seen before. The gentleman said, "I am reminded of an occasion in 1413, when I came south to visit the new king of southern England. The king, a gracious and valiant person, introduced me to his court, telling them of my many marvellous accomplishments, my extensive kingdoms, chivalrous character, etc., etc. However, one of his noblemen chose not to attend to this instructive and elevating speech. Instead, he and his followers stood gossiping and laughing together. I was, as you may imagine, much offended by this treatment, and determined to teach them better manners. The next day, these wicked men were hunting hares near Hatfield Forest. Coming upon them all unawares, I had the happy notion of turning the men into hares and the hares into men. First, the hounds tore their masters to pieces, and then the hares, now in the shape of men, found themselves able to inflict a terrible revenge upon the hounds who had chased and harried them." The gentleman paused to receive Stephen's praises for this feat. But before Stephen could utter a word, the gentleman exclaimed, "Oh, did you feel that?"
"Feel what, sir?" asked Stephen.
"All the doors shook."
Stephen glanced at the stable doors.
"No, not those doors," said the gentleman. "I mean the doors between England and everywhere else. Someone is trying to open them. Someone spoke to the sky, and it was not me. Someone is giving instructions to the stones and rivers, and it is not me. Who is doing that? Who is it? Come."
The gentleman seized Stephen's arm, and they seemed to rise up in the air, as if they were suddenly stood upon a mountain or a very high tower. Harley Street Mews disappeared, and a new scene presented itself to Stephen's eyes, and then another, and then another. Here was a port with a crowd of masts as thick as a forest. It seemed to fly away beneath their feet, and was immediately replaced by a grey winter sea, and ships in full sail bending to the wind. Next came a city with spires and splendid bridges. Curiously, there was scarcely any sensation of movement. It felt more as if the world was flying towards Stephen and the gentleman, while they remained still. Now came snow-covered mountains with tiny people toiling up them. Next, a glassy lake with dark peaks all around it. Then a level country with tiny towns and rivers spread across it like a child's toy. There was something ahead of them. At first it looked like a black line that cut the sky in half, but as they drew nearer, it became a black pillar that reached up from the earth and had no end. Stephen and the gentleman came to rest high above Venice. As to what they might be resting upon, Stephen was determined not to consider. The sun was setting, and the streets and buildings beneath them were dark, but the sea and sky were full of light, in which shades of rose, milky blue, topaz, and pearl were all blended harmoniously together. The city seemed to float in a radiant void. For the most part, the black pillar was as smooth as obsidian,
but just above the level of the house roofs, twists and spirals of darkness were billowing out from it and drifting away through the air. What they could be, Stephen could not imagine. "Is it smoke, sir? Is the tower on fire?" asked Stephen. The gentleman did not reply, but as they drew closer, Stephen saw that it was not smoke. A dark multitude was flying out of the tower. They were ravens. Thousands upon thousands of ravens. They were leaving Venice and flying back in the direction Stephen and the gentleman had come. One flock wheeled towards them. The air was suddenly tumultuous with the beating of a thousand wings, and loud with a thrumming, drumming noise. Clouds of dust and grit flew into Stephen's eyes, nose, and throat. He bent low and cupped his hand over his nose to shut out the stench. When they were gone, he asked in amazement, "What are they, sir?"
"Creatures the magician has made," said the gentleman.
"He is sending them back to England with instructions for the sky and the earth and the rivers and the hills. He is calling up all the king's old allies. Soon they will attend to English magicians rather than to me."
He gave a great howl of mingled anger and despair.
"I have punished him in ways that I never punished my enemies before, yet still he works against me. Why does he not resign himself to his fate? Why does he not despair?"
"I have never heard that he lacked courage, sir," said Stephen. "By all accounts, he did many brave things in the peninsula."
"Courage? What are you talking about? This is not courage. This is malice, pure and simple. We have been negligent, Stephen. We have let the English magicians get the advantage of us. We must find a way to defeat them. We must redouble our efforts to make you king."
Chapter 60. Tempest and Lies. February 1817. Aunt Greysteel had rented a house in Padua, within sight of the fruit market. It was very convenient for everywhere, and only 80 sequins a quarter, which comes to about 38 guineas. Aunt Greysteel was very pleased with her bargain, but it sometimes happens that when one acts quickly and with great resolve, all the indecisiveness and doubt comes afterwards, when it is too late. So it was in this case. Aunt Greysteel and Flora had not been living in the house a week when Aunt Greysteel began to find fault with it, and began to wonder if, in fact, she ought to have taken it at all. Although ancient and pretty, its Gothic windows were rather small, and several of them were fenced about with stone balconies. In other words, it was inclined to be dark. This would never have been a problem before, but just at present, Flora's spirits required support. And, thought Aunt Greysteel, gloom and shadows, be they ever so picturesque, might not in fact be the best thing for her. There were, moreover, some stone ladies who stood about the courtyard, and who had, in the course of the years, acquired veils and cloaks of ivy. It was no exaggeration to say that these ladies were in imminent danger of disappearing altogether, and every time Aunt Greysteel's eye fell upon them, she was put in mind of Jonathan Strange's poor wife, who had died so young and so mysteriously, and whose unhappy fate seemed to have driven her husband mad. Aunt Greysteel hoped that no such melancholy notions occurred to Flora. But the bargain had been made, and the house had been taken, so Aunt Greysteel set about making it as cheerful and bright as she could. She had never squandered candles or lamp oil in her life, but in her endeavor to raise Flora's spirits, she put all questions of expense aside. There was a particularly gloomy spot on the stairs, where a step turned in an odd way that no one could possibly have predicted. And lest anyone should tumble down and break their neck, Aunt Greysteel insisted upon a lamp being placed upon a shelf just above the step. The lamp burnt day and night, and was a continual affront to Bonifazia, the elderly Italian maid who came with the house, and who was an even more economical person than Aunt Greysteel herself. Bonifazia was an excellent servant, but much inclined to criticism and long explanations of why the instructions she had just been given were wrong or impossible to carry out. She was aided in her work by a slow, put-upon sort of young man called Minicello, who greeted any order with a low, grumbling murmur of dialect words quite impossible to comprehend. Bonifazia treated Minicello with such familiar contempt that Aunt Greysteel supposed they must be related, though she had yet to obtain any precise information upon this point. So, what with the arrangements for the house, the daily battles with Bonifazia, and all the discoveries, pleasant or otherwise, attendant upon a sojourn in a new town, Aunt Greysteel's days were full of interesting occupation. But her chief and most sacred duty at this time was to try and find amusement for Flora. Flora had fallen into habits of quiet and solitude. If her aunt spoke to her, she answered cheerfully enough, but few indeed were the conversations that she began. In Venice, Flora had been the chief instigator of all their pleasures. Now she simply fell in with whatever projects of exploration Aunt Greysteel proposed. She preferred those occupations that require no companion. She walked alone, read alone, sat alone in the sitting room or in the ray of faint sunshine, which sometimes penetrated the little courtyard at about 1 o'clock. She was less open-hearted and confiding than before. It was as if someone, not necessarily Jonathan Strange, had disappointed her, and she was determined to be more independent in future. In the first week in February, there was a great storm in Padua. It happened at about the middle of the day. The storm came very suddenly out of the east, from the direction of Venice and the sea. The old man who frequented the town's coffee houses said that there had been no sign of it moments before. But other people were not so much inclined to take notice of this. After all, it was winter, and storms must be expected. First, a great wind blew through the town. It was no respecter of doors or windows, this wind. It seemed to find out chinks that no one knew existed, and it blew almost as fiercely within the houses as without. Aunt Greysteel and Flora were together in a little sitting room on the first floor. The window panes began to rattle, and some crystals that hung from a chandelier began to jingle. Then the pages of a letter that Aunt Greysteel was writing escaped from beneath her hand and went flying about the room. Outside the window, the skies darkened, and it became as black as night. Sheets of blinding rain began to descend. Bonifazia and Minicello entered the sitting room. They came under the pretext of finding out Aunt Greysteel's wishes concerning the storm, but in truth, Bonifazia wanted to join with Aunt Greysteel in exclamations of astonishment at the violence of the wind and rain. And a fine duet they made of it, too, albeit in different languages. Minicello came presumably because Bonifazia did. He regarded the storm gloomily, as if he suspected it of having been arranged on purpose to make work for him. Aunt Greysteel, Bonifazia, and Minicello were all at the window, and saw how the first stroke of lightning turned the whole familiar scene into something quite gothic and disturbing, full of pallid, unearthly glare and unexpected shadows. This was followed by a crack of thunder that shook the whole room. Bonifazio murmured appeals to the Virgin and several saints. Aunt Greysteel, who was equally alarmed, might well have been glad of the same refuge, but as a member of the communion of the Church of England, she could only exclaim, "Dear me," and "Upon my word," and "Lord bless me," none of which gave her much comfort. "Flora, my love," she called out in a voice that quavered slightly, "I hope you are not frightened. It is a very horrid storm." Flora came to the window and took her aunt's hand and told her that it was sure to be over very soon. Another stroke of lightning illuminated the town. Flora dropped her aunt's hand, undid the window fastening, and stepped eagerly out onto the balcony. "Flora!" exclaimed Aunt Greysteel. She was leaning into the howling darkness with both hands upon the balustrade, quite oblivious of the rain that soaked her gown, or of the wind that pulled at her hair. "My love, Flora, Flora, come out of the rain." Flora turned and said something to her aunt, but what it was, they could not hear. Minicello followed her onto the balcony, and, with a surprising delicacy, though without relinquishing for a moment his native gloominess, he managed to herd her inside again, using his large flat hands to guide her, in the same way shepherds use hurdles to direct sheep. "Can you not see?" exclaimed Flora. "There is someone there at the corner. Can you tell who it is? I thought—" She fell silent abruptly, and whatever it was that she thought, she did not say. "Well, my love, I hope you are mistaken. I pity anyone who is in the street at this moment. I hope they'll find some shelter as soon as they can. Oh, Flora, how wet you are."
Bonifazia fetched towels, and then she and Aunt Greysteel immediately set about drying Flora's gown, turning her round and round between them, and sometimes trying to give her a turn in contrary directions. At the same time, both were giving Minicello urgent instructions. Aunt Greysteel in stumbling yet insistent Italian, and Bonifazia in rapid Veneto dialect. The instructions, like the tones, may well have been at odds with each other, because Minicello did nothing except regard them with a baleful expression. Flora gazed over the bowed heads of the two women into the street. Another stroke of lightning. She stiffened, as if she'd been electrified, and the next moment she wriggled out of the clutches of aunt and maid and ran out of the room. They had no time to wonder where she was going. The next half hour was one of titanic domestic struggle, of Minicello trying to close shutters in the teeth of the storm, of Bonifazia stumbling about in the dark looking for candles, of Aunt Greysteel discovering that the Italian word she had been using to mean shutter actually meant parchment. Each of them, in turn, lost his or her temper. Nor did Aunt Greysteel feel that the situation was much improved when all the bells in the town began to ring at once, in accordance with the beliefs that bells, being blessed objects, can dispel storms and thunder, which are clearly works of the devil. At last, the house was secured. Or very nearly. Aunt Greysteel left Bonifazia and Minicello to complete the work, and forgetting that she had seen Flora leave the sitting room, she returned thither with a candle for her niece. Flora was not there, but Aunt Greysteel observed that Minicello still had not closed the shutters in that room. She mounted the stairs to Flora's bedchamber. Flora was not there either. Nor was she in the little dining parlour, nor in Aunt Greysteel's own bedchamber, nor in the other smaller sitting room which they sometimes used after dinner. The kitchen, the vestibule, and the gardener's room were tried next. She was not in any of those places. Aunt Greysteel began to be seriously frightened. A cruel little voice whispered in her ear that whatever mysterious fate had befallen Jonathan Strange's wife, it had begun when she had disappeared very unexpectedly in bad weather. But that was snow, not rain, she told herself. As she went about the house looking for Flora, she kept repeating to herself, snow, not rain, snow, not rain. Then she thought, perhaps she was in the sitting room all along. It was so dark, and she is so quiet. I may well not have perceived her. She returned to the room. Another stroke of lightning gave it an unnatural aspect. The walls became white and ghastly. The furniture and other objects became grey, as if they had all been turned to stone. With a horrible jolt, Aunt Greysteel realized that there was indeed a second person in the room. A woman. But not Flora. A woman in a dark, old-fashioned gown, standing with a candle in a candlestick, looking at her. A woman whose face was entirely in shadow, whose features could not be seen. Aunt Greysteel grew cold all over. There was a crack of thunder, then pitch-black darkness, except for the two candle flames. But somehow, the unknown woman's candle seemed to illuminate nothing at all. Queerer still, the room seemed to have grown larger in some mysterious way. The woman and her candle were strangely distant from Aunt Greysteel. Aunt Greysteel cried out, "Who is there?" No one answered. Of course, she thought, she's Italian. I must ask her again in Italian. Well, perhaps she has wandered into the wrong house in the confusion of the storm. But try as she might, she could not at that moment think of a single Italian word. Another flash of lightning. There was the woman, standing just as she had been before, facing Aunt Greysteel. "'Tis the ghost of Jonathan Strange's wife," she thought. She took a step forward, and so did the unknown woman. Suddenly, realization and relief came upon her in equal measures. "It is a mirror! Oh, how foolish! How foolish to be afraid of my own reflection!" She was so relieved she almost laughed out loud. But then she paused. It had not been foolish to be frightened. Not foolish at all. There had been no mirror in that corner until now. The next flash of lightning showed the mirror to her. It was ugly and much too large for the room. She knew she had never seen it before in her life. She hurried out of the room. She felt she would be able to think more clearly away from the sight of the baleful mirror. She was halfway up the stairs when some sounds that seemed to originate in Flora's bedchamber made her open the door and look inside. There was Flora. She had lit the candles they had placed for her and was in the middle of pulling her gown over her head. The gown was sopping wet. Her petticoat and stockings were no better. Her shoes were tumbled on the floor at the side of the bed. They were quite soaked and spoilt with rain. Flora looked at her aunt with an expression in which guilt, embarrassment, defiance, and several other things more difficult of interpretation were mixed together.
"Nothing. Nothing," she cried.
This, presumably, was the answer to some question she expected her aunt to put to her. But all that Aunt Greysteel said was,
"Oh, my dear, where have you been? Whatever made you go out in such weather?"
I went out to buy some embroidery silk."
Aunt Greysteel must have looked a good deal astonished at this, because Flora added doubtfully,
"I did not think the rain would last so long."
"Well, my love, I must say I think you acted rather foolishly, but you must have been a good deal frightened.
Was it that that made you cry?"
"Cry?
No, no, you're mistaken, Aunt. I've not been crying. It is rain, that is all."
"But you're..."
Aunt Greysteel stopped. She'd been going to say,
"You are crying now."
But Flora shook her head and turned away. For some reason, she had wrapped her shawl into a bundle, and Aunt Greysteel could not help thinking that if she had not done that, the shawl would have given her some protection from the rain, and she would not now be so wet. From out of the bundle, she took a little bottle half full of an amber-colored liquid. She opened a drawer and put it inside.
"Flora, something very peculiar has happened. I don't know quite how to tell you, but there is a mirror."
"Yes,
I know," said Flora quickly. "It belongs to me."
"Belongs to you?"
Aunt Greysteel was more perplexed than ever. A pause of some moments' duration.
"Where did you buy it?" she asked.
It was all she could think of to say.
"I do not remember exactly. It must have been delivered just now."
"But surely no one would deliver anything in the middle of a storm. And even if anybody had been so foolish as to do such a thing, they would have knocked upon the door, and not done it in this strange, secret way."
To these very reasonable arguments, Flora made no reply. Aunt Greysteel was not sorry to let the subject drop. She was quite sick of storms and frights and unexpected mirrors. The question of why the mirror had appeared was now resolved, and so, for the present, she put aside the question of how it had appeared. She was glad to fall back upon the more soothing subjects of Flora's gown and Flora's shoes, and the likelihood of Flora's catching cold, and the necessity for Flora drying herself immediately and putting on her dressing gown and coming and sitting by the fire in the sitting room and eating something hot. When they were both in the sitting room again, Aunt Greysteel said,
"See, storm is almost past. It seems to be going back towards the coast. How odd. I thought that was the direction it came from. I suppose your embroidery silks were ruined by the rain along with everything else."
"Embroidery silks?"
said Flora. Then remembering,
"Oh, I did not get so far as the shop. It was, as you say, a foolish undertaking."
"Well, we can go out later and get whatever you need.
How sorry I am for the poor market people. Everything on the stalls will have been spoiled.
Bonifazia is making your gruel, my love. I wonder if I told her to use the new milk."
"I do not remember, Aunt."
"Well, I'd better go and just mention it."
"I can go, Aunt,"
said Flora, proposing to stand up. But her aunt would not hear of it. Flora must remain exactly where she was, at the fireside, with her feet upon a footstool. It was becoming lighter by the moment. Before proceeding to the kitchen, Aunt Greysteel surveyed the mirror. It was very large and ornate, the sort of mirror, in fact, that is made on the island of Murano in the Venetian Lagoon.
"I confess I'm surprised at your liking this mirror, Flora. It has so many scrolls and curlicues and glass flowers. Generally, you prefer simple things."
Flora sighed and said she supposed she had acquired a taste for what was sumptuous and elaborate since she'd been in Italy.
"Was it expensive?"
asked Aunt Greysteel.
"It looks expensive."
"No, not expensive at all."
"Well, that is something, is it not?"
Aunt Greysteel went down the stairs to the kitchen. She was feeling a good deal recovered, and felt confident that the train of shocks and alarms of which the morning seemed to have been composed was now at an end. But in this, she was quite wrong. Standing in the kitchen with Bonifazia and Minicello were two men she had never seen before. Bonifazia did not appear to have begun making Flora's gruel. She had not even fetched the oatmeal and milk out of the pantry. The moment Bonifazio laid her eyes upon Aunt Greysteel, she took her by the hand and unleashed a flood of eager dialect words upon her. She was speaking of the storm, that much was clear, and saying it was evil. But beyond that, Aunt Greysteel understood very little. To her absolute astonishment, it was Minicello who helped her comprehend it. In a very reasonable counterfeit of the English language, he said,
"The magician English makes it. The magician English makes the tempesta."
I beg your pardon?
With frequent interruptions from Bonifazio and the two men, Minicello informed her that in the midst of the storm, several people had looked up and seen a cleft in the black clouds. But what they had seen through the cleft had astonished and terrified them. It had not been the clear azure that they were expecting, but a black midnight sky full of stars. The storm had not been natural at all. It had been contrived in order to hide the approach of strangers' pillar of darkness. This news was soon known all over the town, and the citizens were greatly disturbed by it. Until now, the pillar of darkness had been a horror confined to Venice, which seemed, to the Paduans at least, a natural setting for horrors. Now it was clear that Strange had stayed in Venice by choice rather than enchantment. Any city in Italy, any city in the world, might suddenly find itself visited by eternal darkness. Well, this was bad enough, but for Aunt Greysteel it was much worse. To all her fear of Strange was added the unwelcome conviction that Flora had lied. She debated with herself whether it was more likely that her niece had lied because she was under the influence of a spell, or because her attachment to Strange had weakened her principles. She did not know which would be worse. She wrote to her brother in Venice, begging him to come. In the meantime, she determined to say nothing. For the rest of the day, she observed Flora closely. Flora was much as usual, except there sometimes seemed to be a tinge of penitence in her behaviour to her aunt, where no tinge ought to have been. At 1 o'clock on the next day, some hours before Aunt Greysteel's letter could have reached him, Dr. Greysteel arrived with Frank from Venice. They told her that it had been no secret in Venice when Strange left the parish of Santa Maria Zobenigo and went to Terra Firma. The pillar of darkness had been seen from many parts of the city moving across the face of the sea. Its surface had flickered, and twists and spirals of darkness had darted in and out, so that it appeared to be made of black flames. How Strange had contrived to cross over the water, whether he had travelled in a boat or whether his passage had been purely magical, was not known. The storm by which he had tried to hide his approach had not been conjured up until he got to Strae, 8 miles from Padua.
"I tell you, Louisa," said Dr. Greysteel, "I would not exchange with him now upon any consideration. Everyone fled at his approach. From Maestra to Strae he could not have seen another living creature. Nothing but silent streets and abandoned fields. Henceforth the world is an empty place to him."
A few moments before, Aunt Greysteel had been thinking of Strange with no very tender feelings, but the picture that her brother conjured up was so shocking that tears started into her eyes.
"And where is he now?" she asked in a softened tone.
"He has gone back to his rooms in Santa Maria Zobenigo," said Dr. Greysteel. "All is just as it was. As soon as we heard he had been in Padua, I guessed what his object was. We came as soon as we could. How is Flora?"
Flora was in the drawing room. She had been expecting her father. Indeed, she seemed relieved that the interview had come at last. Dr. Greysteel had scarcely got out his first question when she burst forth with her confession. It was the release of an overcharged heart. Her tears fell abundantly, and she admitted that she had seen Strange. She had seen him in the street below, and known that he was waiting for her, and so she had run out of the house to meet him.
"I will tell you everything, I promise," she said. "But not yet. I have done nothing wrong. I mean," she blushed, "apart from the falsehoods I told my aunt, for which I'm very sorry. But these secrets are not mine to tell."
"But why must there be secrets at all, Flora?" asked her father. "Does that not tell you that there's something wrong? People whose intentions are honourable do not have secrets. They act openly."
"Yes, I suppose. Oh, but that does not apply to magicians. Mr. Strange has enemies, that terrible old man in London, and others besides. But you must not scold me for doing wrong. I have tried so hard to do good, and I believe I have. You see, There is a sort of magic which he's been practicing, and which is destroying him. And yesterday I persuaded him to give it up. He made me a promise to abandon it completely.
But Flora, said her father sadly, this distresses me more than all the rest. That you should regard yourself as entitled to exact promises from him is something which requires explanation. Surely you must see that, my dear. Are you engaged to him?
No, Papa.
Another burst of tears. It took a great many caresses from her aunt to restore her to tolerable calm. When she could speak again, she said,
There is no engagement. It is true that I was attached to him once, but that is all over and done with. You must not suspect me of it. It was for friendship's sake that I asked him to promise me, and for his wife's sake. He thinks he is doing it for her, but I know that she would not want him to do magic, so destructive of his health and reason. Whatever the object, however desperate the circumstances, she is no longer able to guide his actions, and so it fell to me to speak on her behalf.
Dr. Greysteel was silent. Flora, he said after a minute or two, you forget, my dear, that I have seen him often in Venice. He is in no condition to keep promises. He will not even remember what promise he has made.
Oh, but he will. I have arranged matters so that he must.
A fresh return of tears seemed to show that she was not quite free of love, as she claimed. But she had said enough to make her father and aunt a little easier in their minds. They were convinced that her attachment to Jonathan Strange must come to a natural close sooner or later. As Aunt Greysteel said later that evening, Flora was not the sort of girl to spend years in longing for an impossible love. She was too rational a creature. Now that they were all together again, Dr. Greysteel and Aunt Greysteel were eager to continue their travels. Aunt Greysteel wished to go to Rome to see the ancient buildings and artifacts which they had heard were so remarkable. But Flora no longer had any interest in remains or works of art. She was happiest, she said, where she was. Most of the time, she would not even leave the house unless absolutely forced to it. When they proposed a walk or a visit to a church with a Renaissance altarpiece, she declined to accompany them. She would complain that it was raining or that the streets were wet, all of which was true. There was a great deal of rain in Padua that winter, but the rain had never troubled her before. Her aunt and father were patient, though Dr. Greysteel in particular thought it a little hard. He had not come to Italy to sit quietly in an apartment half the size of the rooms in his own comfortable house in Wiltshire. In private, he grumbled that it was perfectly possible to read novels or embroider in Wiltshire. These were now Flora's favourite pursuits, and a good deal cheaper, too. But Aunt Greysteel scolded him and made him hush. If this was the way in which Flora intended to grieve for Jonathan Strange, then they must let her. Flora did propose one expedition, but that was of a most peculiar sort. After Dr. Greysteel had been in Padua about a week, she announced that she had a great desire to be upon the sea. Did she mean a sea voyage, they asked? There was no reason why they should not go to Rome or Naples by sea. But she did not mean a sea voyage. She did not wish to leave Padua. No, what she would like would be to go out in a yacht or other sort of boat. Only for an hour or two, perhaps less. But she would like to go immediately. The next day, they repaired to a small fishing village. The village had no particular advantages of situation, prospect, architecture, or history. In fact, it had very little to recommend it at all, other than its proximity to Padua. Dr. Greysteel inquired in the little wine shop and at the priest's house until he heard of two steady fellows who would be willing to take them out upon the water. The men had no objection to taking Dr. Greysteel's money, but they were obliged to point out that there was nothing to see. There would have been nothing to see even in good weather, but it was not good weather. It was raining, hard enough to make an excursion on the water most uncomfortable, not quite hard enough to dispel the heavy grey mist.
Are you sure, my love, that this is what you want? Asked Aunt Greysteel. It is a dismal spot, and the boat smells very strongly of fish. I am quite sure, Aunt, said Flora,
and climbed into the boat and settled herself at one end. Her aunt and father followed her. The mystified fisherman sailed out until all that could be seen in any direction was a shifting mass of grey water, confined by walls of dull grey mist. The fisherman looked expectantly at Dr. Greysteel. He, in turn, looked questioningly at Flora. Flora took no notice of any of them. She was seated, leaning against the side of the boat in a pensive attitude. Her right arm was stretched out over the water.
"There it is again," cried Dr. Greysteel.
"There is what again?"
asked Aunt Greysteel irritably.
"That smell of cats and mustiness. A smell like the old woman's room. The old woman we visited in Cannareggio. Is there a cat on board?"
The question was absurd. Every part of the fishing boat was visible from every other part. There was no cat.
"Is anything the matter, my love?" asked Aunt Greysteel.
There was something in Flora's posture she did not quite like.
"Are you ill?"
"No, Aunt,"
said Flora, straightening herself and adjusting her umbrella.
"I am well. We can go back now, if you wish."
For a moment, Aunt Greysteel saw a little bottle floating upon the waves, a little bottle with no stopper. Then it sank beneath the water and was gone forever. This peculiar expedition was the last time for many weeks that Flora would show any inclination to go out. Sometimes Aunt Greysteel would try to persuade her to sit in a chair by the window so that she could see what was going on in the street. In an Italian street, there is often something amusing going on. But Flora was greatly attached to a chair in a shadowy corner, beneath the eerie mirror. And she acquired a peculiar habit of comparing the picture of the room as it was contained in the mirror and the room as it really was. She might, for example, suddenly become interested in a shawl that was thrown across a chair and look at its reflection and say, "That shawl looks different in the mirror."
"Does it?"
Aunt Greysteel would say, puzzled.
"Yes. It looks brown in the mirror, whereas in truth it is blue. Do you not think so?"
"Well, my dear, I'm sure you're right, but it looks just the same to me."
"No,"
Flora would say with a sigh.
"You are right."
Chapter 61. Tree speaks to stone, stone speaks to water. January to February, 1817. When Mr. Norrell had destroyed Strange's book, public opinion in England had been very much against him, and very much in favour of Strange. Comparisons were made, both publicly and privately, between the two magicians. Strange was open, courageous, and energetic, whereas secrecy seemed to be the beginning and end of Mr. Norrell's character. Nor was it forgotten how, when Strange was in the peninsula, in the service of his country, Norrell had bought up all the books of magic in the Duke of Roxburgh's library so that no one else could read them. By the middle of January, the newspapers were full of reports of Strange's madness, descriptions of the Black Tower, and speculations concerning the magic which held him there. An Englishman called Lister had been at Mestre, on the Italian coast, on the day Strange had left Venice and gone to Padua. Mr. Lister had witnessed the passage of the Pillar of Darkness over the sea, and sent back an account to England. 3 weeks later, accounts appeared in several London newspapers of how it had glided silently over the face of the waters. In the space of a few short months, Strange had become a symbol of horror to his countrymen, a damned creature, scarcely human. But Strange's sudden fall from grace did little to benefit Mr. Norrell. He received no new commissions from the government, and worse yet, commissions from other sources were cancelled. In early January, the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral had inquired whether Mr. Norrell might be able to discover the burial place of a certain dead young woman. The young woman's brother wished to erect a new monument to all the members of his family. This entailed moving the young woman's coffin, but the Dean and Chapter were most embarrassed to discover that her burial place had been written down wrongly, and they did not know where she was. Mr. Norrell had assured him that it would be the easiest thing in the world to find her. As soon as the Dean informed him of the young lady's name and one or two other details, he would do the magic. But the Dean did not send Mr. Norrell her name. Instead, an awkwardly phrased letter had arrived in which the Dean made many elaborate apologies and said how he had recently been struck by the inappropriateness of clergymen employing magicians. Lascelles and Norrell agreed that the situation was a worrying one. "It will be difficult to sustain the restoration of English magic if no new magic is done," said Lascelles. "At this crisis,
It is imperative that we bring your name and achievements continually before the public.
Lascelles wrote articles for the newspapers, and he denounced Strange in all the magical journals. He also took the opportunity to review the magic that Mr. Norrell had done in the past 10 years and suggest improvements. He decided that he and Mr. Norrell should go down to Brighton to look at the wall of spells that Mr. Norrell and Jonathan Strange had cast around Britain's coast. It had occupied the greater part of Mr. Norrell's time for the past 2 years, and had cost the government a vast sum of money. So, on a particularly icy, windy day in February, they stood together at Brighton and contemplated a wide stretch of featureless grey sea.
"It is invisible," said Lascelles.
"Invisible, yes," agreed Mr. Norrell eagerly, "but no less efficacious for that. It will protect the cliffs from erosion, people's houses from storm, livestock from being swept away, and it will capsize any enemies of Britain who attempt to land.
But could you not have placed beacons at regular intervals to remind people that the magic wall is there? Burning flames hovering mysteriously over the face of the waters, pillars shaped out of seawater, something of that sort?"
"Oh," said Mr. Norrell. "To be sure. I could create the magical illusions you mentioned. They are not at all difficult to do, but you must understand that they would be purely ornamental. They would not strengthen the magic in any way whatsoever. They would have no practical effect."
"Their effect," said Lascelles severely, "would be to stand as a constant reminder to every onlooker of the works of the great Mr. Norrell. They would let the British people know that you are still the defender of the nation, eternally vigilant, watching over them while they go about their business. It would be worth 10, 20 articles in the reviews."
"Indeed," said Mr. Norrell. He promised that in future he would always bear in mind the necessity of doing magic to excite the public imagination.
They stayed that night in the Old Ship Tavern, and the following morning they returned to London. As a rule, Mr. Norrell detested long journeys. Though his carriage was a most superior example of the carriage-maker's art, with everything in the way of iron springs and thick padded seats, still he felt every bump and dent in the road. After half an hour or so, he would begin to suffer from pains in his back, and aches in his head, and queasinesses in his stomach. But upon this particular morning, he scarcely gave thought to his back or his stomach at all. From the first moment of setting off from the Old Ship, he was in a curiously nervous condition, beset by unexpected ideas and half-formed fears. Through the carriage glass, he saw great numbers of large black birds, whether ravens or crows he did not know, and in his magician's heart he was sure that they meant something. Against the pale winter sky they wheeled and turned and spread their wings like black hands, and as they did so, each one became a living embodiment of the raven in flight, John Usglass's banner. Mr. Norrell asked Lascelles if he thought the birds were more numerous than usual, but Lascelles said he did not know. After the birds, the next thing to haunt Mr. Norrell's imagination were the wide, cold puddles that were thickly strewn across every field. As the carriage passed along the road, each puddle became a silver mirror for the blank winter sky. To a magician, there is very little difference between a mirror and a door. England seemed to be wearing thin before his eyes. He felt as if he might pass through any of those mirror doors and find himself in one of the other worlds which once bordered upon England. Worse still, he was beginning to think that other people might do it. The Sussex landscape began to look uncomfortably like the England described in the old ballad. "This land is all too shallow, it is painted on the sky, and trembles like the wind-shook rain when the Raven King passed by." Footnote 1. See Chapter 3, footnote 1. For the first time in his life, Mr. Norrell began to feel that perhaps there was too much magic in England. When they reached Hanover Square, Mr. Norrell and Lascelles went immediately to the library. Childermas was there, seated at a desk. A pile of letters lay in front of him, and he was reading one of them. He looked up when Mr. Norrell entered the room.
"Good. You're back. Read this."
"Why, what is it?"
"It is from a man called Traquair. A young man in Nottinghamshire has saved a child's life by magic, and Traquair was a witness to it."
"Really, Mr. Childermas," said Lascelles with a sigh. "I thought you knew better than to trouble your master with such nonsense." He glanced at the pile of opened letters.
One had a large seal displaying someone's arms. He stared at it for several moments before he realized that he knew it well and snatched it up. "Mr. Gnarl," he cried, "we have a summons from Lord Liverpool."
"At last," exclaimed Mr. Gnarl.
"What does he say?" Lascelles took a moment to read the letter.
"Only that he begs the favour of our attendance at Fife House upon a matter of the utmost urgency,"
he thought rapidly.
"It is probably the Yeomanites. Liverpool ought to have requested your assistance years ago to deal with the Yeomanites. I'm glad he realises it at last. And as for you," he said, turning upon Childermas, "are you quite mad, or do you have some game of your own to play? You chatter on about false claims of magic while a letter from the Prime Minister of England lies unattended on the desk."
"Lord Liverpool can wait," said Childermas to Mr. Gnarl.
"Believe me when I tell you that you need to know the contents of this letter."
Lascelles gave a snort of exasperation. Mr. Gnarl looked from one to the other. He was entirely at a loss. For years he'd been accustomed to rely upon both of them, and their quarrels, which were becoming increasingly frequent, unnerved him completely. He might have stood there, unable to choose between them for some time, had not Childermas decided matters by seizing his arms and pulling him bodily into a small panelled antechamber which led off the library. Childermas shut the door with a bang and leant on it.
"Listen to me. This magic happened at a grand house in Nottinghamshire. The grown-ups were talking in the drawing-room, the servants were busy, and a little girl wandered off into the garden. She climbed a high wall that borders a kitchen garden and walked along the top of it. But the wall was covered in ice, and she tumbled down and fell through the roof of a hothouse. The glass broke and pierced her in many places. A servant heard her screaming. There was no surgeon nearer than 10 miles away. One of the party, a young man called Joseph Abney, saved her by magic. He drew the shards of glass out of her and mended the broken bones with Martin Pale's Restoration and Rectification."
Footnote 2. Restoration and Rectification was a spell which reversed the effects of a recent calamity.
"And he stopped the flow of blood using a spell which he claimed was Tilo's Hand."
Footnote 3. Tilo's Hand was an ancient fairy spell which halted all sorts of things: rain, fire, wind, coursing water, or blood. It presumably was named after the fairy who had first taught it to an English magician.
"Ridiculous," declared Mr. Gnarl. "Tilo's Hand has been lost for hundreds of years, and Pale's Restoration and Rectification is a very difficult procedure. This young man would have had to study for years and years."
"Yes, I know. And he admits that he has hardly studied at all. He barely knew the names of the spells, let alone their execution. Yet Traquair said that he performed the spells fluidly, without hesitation. Traquair and the other people who were present spoke to him and asked him what he was doing. The girl's father was much alarmed to see Abney perform magic upon her, but so far as they could tell, Abney did not hear them. Afterwards he was like a man coming out of a dream. All he could say was, 'Tree speaks to stone, stone speaks to water.' He seemed to think that the trees and the sky had told him what to do."
"Mystical nonsense."
"Perhaps, and yet I do not think so. Since we came to London, I have read hundreds of letters from people who think they can do magic, and are mistaken. But this is different. This is true. I would stake money upon it. Besides, there are other letters here from people who've tried spells, and the spells have worked. But what I do not understand is..."
But at that moment, the door against which Childermas was leaning was subject to a great rattling and shaking. A blow hit it, and Childermas was thrown away from the door and against Mr. Gnarl. The door opened to reveal Lucas, and behind him, Davy the coachman.
"Oh," said Lucas, somewhat surprised. "I beg your pardon, sir. I didn't know you were here. Mr. Lascelles said the door had jammed shut, and Davy and I were trying to free it. The carriage is ready, sir, to take you to Lord Liverpool."
"Come, Mr. Gnarl," cried Lascelles from within the library. "Lord Liverpool is waiting."
Mr. Gnarl cast a worried glance at Childermas and went. The journey to Fife House was not a very pleasant one for Mr. Gnarl. Lascelles was full of spite towards Childermas and lost no time in venting it.
"Forgive me for saying so, Mr. Gnarl," he said, "but you have no one but yourself to blame. Sometimes it seems like wisdom to allow an intelligent servant a certain degree of independence,
but one always regrets it in the end. That villain has grown in insolence until he thinks nothing of contradicting you and insulting your friends. My father whipped men for less, a great deal less, I assure you. And I should like, oh, I should like. Lascelles twitched and fidgeted and threw himself back upon the cushions. In a moment, he said in a calmer tone, I advise you to consider, sir, if your need of him is really as great as you think. How many of his sympathies are with Strange, I wonder? Yes, that is the real question, is it not? He looked out of the glass at the bleak grey buildings. We are here, Mr. Norrell. I beg that you will remember what I told you. Whatever the difficulties of the magic which his lordship requires, do not dwell upon them. A long explanation will not make them grow any less. Mr. Norrell and Lascelles found Lord Liverpool in his study, standing by the table where he conducted a great deal of his business. With him was Lord Sidmouth, the Home Secretary. They fixed Mr. Norrell with solemn looks. Lord Liverpool said, I have here letters from the Lord Lieutenants of Lincolnshire, Yorkshire, Somerset, Cornwall, Warwickshire, and Cumbria. Lascelles could scarcely refrain from giving a sigh of pleasure at the magic and the money that seemed to be in prospect. All complaining of the magic that has recently occurred in those counties. Mr. Norrell blinked his eyes rapidly.
I beg your pardon?
Lascelles said quickly. Mr. Norrell knows nothing of any magic done in those places. Lord Liverpool gave him a cool look, as if he did not believe him. There was a pile of papers on the table. Lord Liverpool picked one up at random. 4 days ago in the town of Stamford, he said, a Quaker girl and her friend were telling each other secrets. They heard a noise and discovered their younger brothers listening at the door. Full of indignation, they chased the boys into the garden. There they joined hands and recited a charm. The boys' ears leapt off their heads and flew away. It was not until the boys had made a solemn oath never to do such a thing again that the ears could be coaxed back out of the bare rose bushes, which is where they had alighted, and persuaded to return to the boys' heads.